I'm pleased to introduce Larry Siff as our moderator for this program. Larry's Managing Director of Neptune Advisors. As mentioned before, the mission is to grow middle market companies by sourcing and structuring mergers and acquisitions, leveraging brands, and providing operational and financial improvements. Prior to this, Larry was principal and managing director at Gordon Brothers, a $50 billion investment and transaction advisory firm. At Gordon Brothers, he founded the consumer products and branding business. He grew it to become two of the firm's largest divisions. As director of strategic acquisitions, he led acquisitions ranging from $5 million to $1.2 billion. He served on the executive committee. He was an advisor to GBMP, an equity and debt fund. Over his 25 years, he's also been a line operating executive. He was president and CEO of Baby Stripes, an online retailer of luxury baby gifts. He was president of and CEO of Cherry Tree Products, a manufacturer, wholesaler, and retailer of high-end children's clothing. He's been CEO of Ambassador Shoe, BMW Footwear, and BWA International, where he established operations at 38 factories in 9 countries and then successfully sold the company. Larry began his career at Procter & Gamble. He created the wholesale club division, which today accounts for $3 billion in sales. Larry serves on the board of directors of CO3 Systems and Imagination Brands. He is industry advisor for Silverwood Partners, which is a boutique investment bank. Larry is trustee at the Museum of Science here in Boston. He's director of the Asia America Chamber of Commerce, the 210 International Footwear Foundation, and the Windsor School. He is past chairman of the board of Brimmer and May School and past director of the Association for Corporate Growth. He graduated from Brown University and the executive program at Dartmouth's Amos Tuck. He is also a contributor to Forbes magazine.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
But I know some of you, as you went around introducing yourself, you described if you're board members. Can we just have a hand? How many are board members today of for-profit companies? And how many non-profit companies board members? Right, that's helpful. Okay, so you have a lot more to add than I can possibly add up here. So I want to start with a couple pieces of information. McKinsey survey said 3 out of 4 directors want to be spending a minimum of a quarter of their time dealing with a company's business strategy risks and maximizing growth opportunities. And then you take that with Bain Consulting that also did a survey showing that only 1 out of every 10 companies succeed in sustained growth. And so you sort of combine these two and you realize our board members really spending time asking the questions they need to be asking in terms of growth. So I'm just gonna give you some of my thoughts, start with this, but I'm really doing this to make it a much more interactive discussion. So please comment and ask any questions on this. Let me just start with some thoughts. I mean, we obviously work with a number of our clients in terms of the boards, and there are family-controlled boards, and there are non-family-controlled boards, and there are non-family CEOs running the boards, and there are CEOs running the boards. But, I mean, what we really see is that what is the general role of the board? The board is to have adult supervision in the room a lot of times. The board is not to be a cheerleader, nor overbearing in management. It really needs to be an effective partner and supervisor, and not get into the details, the minutiae, but only as a means of understanding the big picture. And as you start with that as sort of the framework of the role of the board, I mean, I want to hear some of your thoughts in terms of, what questions you think that board members should be asking the CEO about growth plans. So. Any questions?
I have a question. In fact, you have to say the boards want to spend 25% of their time dealing with those issues.
Right.
Well,
a lot is today. It's in compliance and governance and all the other issues. Unfortunately, that's what's required. And as opposed to being much more strategic. So, well, I'll keep going then. You know, what we see is you need to keep a focus on the bigger and longer picture to steer the company for the future. You must know the present, but be able to map out the future of companies and be able to validate the results to make sure they're both accurate and sustainable. It's easy to get overly involved with what's going on currently and not really focus on the future of the company and the sustainability of that. And as a board member, we believe that board members need to be focused on how the assets are being employed. Are they being employed efficiently? And they being employed sustainable for the future? And so we sort of see a couple areas in terms of questions that board members should be asking for growth. First is, you know, is the CEO conversant in space and white space for future growth? In other words, positive and negatives to get into new opportunities for the company, positive and negatives to grow the company to the next level. I mean, when we tend to get involved with these companies, what we find is, and even yesterday, Doug and I were a client of ours who complained about, I'm running fire drills, I'm running the day-to-day operation. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you really need to focus on your strategy and your future. And then the question is, what can you do to take your company to the next level, to build it up to the next level? And there are several strategies you can employ. One is looking at focusing on what is the company good at today, so their core competencies. The second area is, okay, what assets are we not leveraging properly? And one of the assets we see across the board, pretty much across the board in all the companies, particularly the ones we deal with in the middle market, is brands. So intangible assets, brands, patents, trademarks, people don't honestly know how to leverage them properly within the company. We have clients who are celebrating 100th year anniversaries and haven't done any planning for the 100th year anniversary and 75 year anniversary. And it's a huge opportunity for that company to be out there. There aren't many companies that make it through third and fourth generations to the 100 years anyways. I mean, it should be a celebration. It should be a celebration internally and externally. It should be a consistent branding experience for everywhere. And again, what we find is they don't often plan for their future. A second thing we think that you need to ask as a board member is, what will it take for the company to grow? And we believe that no matter what path they choose, whether they want to grow organically within the company or whether they want to grow through acquisition externally, and we also do a lot of advising on that, is that they have to take a thoughtful, disciplined approach. And they have to understand what's the internal capacity for the company to even get into these new areas, to get into these new spaces, to do this acquisition. So it's great to say you're going to do an acquisition, and sometimes it makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. But what we find is a lot of the companies don't think about, again, strategically. We call it the overlapping effect. So start with, what are your assets, your company A, and you're looking to acquire company B. What are their assets? What are you getting? And then also reverse it. So why are they selling to you? You know, think about all the things. And what we find is they're often not thinking through it. Sometimes we'll say, don't do the acquisition. We had a client last year who was going to do, at the time it was an eight-figure acquisition. And when we did this whole overlapping effect, what we found is they only wanted a portion of this company. So like, so you're going to acquire this company, but you really only need about 20% of the company? Yeah, well, that probably doesn't make sense. It may make more sense. We know who else is looking at this company. We believe we know the top two players in particular who are going to acquire it. Why don't we approach them, try to partner with them, and say, by the way, we're interested in this piece. Turns out one of the players in particular had no interest in that piece. So we went to them, we approached them, and they ended up actually acquiring the company knowing they were going to sell off this piece. So that's a win-win for our client. So one, they didn't spend money they didn't need to spend. Two, you know, they need to do an internal analysis of what do we have and what are our assets, and then what is this company that we're looking to acquire, and what do we really want and what are we getting for it? Because when you go through, yeah. No, no.
One is, was it an outside perspective that was critical for them to see that? Number one. Number two, what are the 3 to 5 issues you see that are inhibiting growth for these companies?
Okay. So let me answer the first one. Yes, I believe outside perspective was key to them seeing this. Because I think what happens within companies is you have a champion. In this case, it was the CEO. And the CFO is going to say to the CEO, hey, I'm not going to do this. I mean, they're often not going to go against the CEO. And the CEO was the champion saying, this makes sense. And he was showing the whole management team, it's acquisition, it's going to really take our sales up, and it's going to be incremental to the bottom. So yeah, I think you need someone with an outside perspective to come in and say, you know what, explain me, what are you getting here? You know, and when I say the overlapping thing, you're getting these customers. Well, you have these customers. So you're getting this many more? Are you really getting incremental customers here? You talk about these product lines. Well, okay, can you take these product lines to your current customer? Like, what is it going to do for your business? And a lot of that is not thought through. Sure.
We all talk about focus on decision making.
Right.
So couldn't they see those risks? If not, why not? Was there lack of transparency, lack of data, lack of visual, lack of something? What was the lack of?
It was all there. I think that this.
The data was there?
The data was there. The data was definitely there. I think that what happens is the CEO is still running his current business, and he's running a nine-figure business. So it's not a small, but you know, several hundred million dollar business of itself. So he's focused on running the business, and now he's taken on something else. And that's the way it's looked at. And he got behind this, and there was no one on that management team was going to say, this doesn't make sense, or why aren't we just buying a piece of it? And so, in my opinion, you need someone on the outside to really do the analysis. And let them, you know, let the CEO, let the manager keep running the business, but have someone do the investigative work and understand what you're really getting versus what you're not getting in it. And, you know, in this case, it didn't make sense. I mean, he was better off just not actually bidding for it. So that's a very different approach now.
What about the top three to five issues you see in the
Okay, so top 3 to 5 issues that inhibit growth. One is people, and in terms of, you know, often it's the CEO of the company that's actually inhibiting the growth. If you think about it like a balloon, when they're starting the company and they're filling up the air in the balloon, then as they get the company going after many years, they end up sort of tying the knot on that balloon, they're no longer filling it up. So I think that the same attitude, initiative, excitement that they start businesses with is not continued throughout. So they get in their own way. They become very conservative. They become, they're not risk takers the way they first were. And so so I think that's one of the things. Second thing is they use the companies as lifestyle companies. So they say, well, at the end of the year, as long as I can end up with X amount of money, and you know, I can continue to go to the country club, I can continue to play golf, I can continue to drive my Mercedes, they view them as lifestyle companies, as opposed to, okay, do you really want to maximize the value of your company? You know, how do we take your company to the next level? How do you increase your revenues? How do you increase your top line? How do you focus on the EBITDA? You know, do you understand where the profit drivers are of your company? So that would be a third thing. Most CEOs don't understand where the profits are made. When they think they know, if you get in there and actually analyze the companies, most of them are wrong most of the time when it comes to that. And then you say, if you don't understand where your money's made, how do you know where to focus, right? How do you know where to do acquisitions? How do you know where to grow? It becomes a huge problem.
So are you saying that CEOs have got the company for that balloon, have got the people for the next stage?
It all depends. Often they're not. It's very dependent on the individual and the company. You know, it's pretty rare today when the CEO will step back and say, look, I'm not the one to take this to the next level. Now, I've gotten
to hire
a
CEO.
Absolutely. They could. The issue is when they hire a CEO, COO, are they really going to empower the COO or not? I mean, are they really going to let the COO do what the CEO needs to do? And what happens is the CEO is used to running it. I mean, we often say to some of our clients, so you're telling us this company's been professional. You used to have all the systems. You've empowered your people. Yeah, great. Take the next month off and don't call in. I'm sorry, what? I can't do that. What do you mean? The company won't make it. You know, go down the drain. Okay. So therefore, the people aren't empowered. The systems aren't set up. The process, I mean, you know that just by asking those questions. So The answer is it's very dependent on the individual. And there's certain individuals who are great at doing startups and can get companies to $10 million level, and then you can get them to $25 million. They're not necessarily ones who can take it to $50 or $100 million levels.
Markets are changing rapidly, in my view. I think that my experience with mid-sized organizations is that many of them guess at where their market is and where it's going.
All right.
They know near term, but you get further than a few months out, they really don't know. And they don't put much stock into thinking about it and looking at it.
Right.
That's the backdrop for growth, in my view. Mm-hmm. What's your observation around that? What's your experience? Is that a gap that's a big gap for a lot of people, or
yes.
Do I need to worry about it and it'll just happen?
No, it's a huge gap. I mean, I was going through my list of the three, but one of the things is understanding the potential size of the marketplace and what marketplace you're actually playing in is another huge issue. And what we find is most companies, particularly middle market companies, they don't have the inside ability to be able to even do the research. And they don't take advantage of their own internal people to get the research they can about the competitors in the marketplace. So often we're dealing with, you know, who's out there in front of your customer? Your salespeople. Great. So your salespeople are sitting down with customers. What are they asking? Are they saying, who's doing better than us? You know, tell me about XYZ competitor. What are they doing that I'm not doing? Are they asking the right questions? And then, is the company actually have a formalized mechanism for gathering the information to bring it in-house? And none of that exists in most of these companies. But you're right, they don't understand the marketplace. And if you ask them, you get some very vague answers, or you get some answers that just make no sense in terms of, you know, what, but, you know, the other thing to look at is just strategically where you position the marketplace. And is there an opportunity for growth within that? So, you know, we had a client we were with last week who it's in a marketplace, pretty much owns that marketplace, but there's no growth expansion in that marketplace. So we said, have you thought about this other marketplace, going down market in their case? And they said, yeah, we've considered. So we're coming up with some different options for them. So all of a sudden, you can expand your own marketplace in terms of it. Same with brands. You know, you can expand where the brand is. You can do co-brand. You can do licensing. You have a lot of opportunities. And a number of these companies don't take advantage of the power of their brand in the marketplace.
Question: How does the role of a board member shift between the times the ideas where the CEO is the one who's in love with the idea and the
right.
acquisition or the growth pattern, or when it's another one of the C-level people that are involved? How does that affect the board?
In terms of
how they relate to the CEO and the role that the CEO has.
Yeah, that's very different. It really depends on who the board members are. I mean, you have these boards where the board members are just friends of the CEOs, and they have close relationships with them. And, you know, those often aren't the best boards. Same with some of the family boards that we all, I'm sure, deal with. You know, granted, they can be on the board because they're a family member, but are they the best qualified to be on that board? Do they have the necessary skill set? So, you know, part of the issues is, you know, how committed is the CEO to the growth of the company? And two, are the board members really going to start to question the CEO? Do they feel comfortable questioning the CEO? And not in an antagonistic way, but just challenging, saying, does this make sense? You know, how are the board members acting very strategically in terms of how they approach the company? And, you know, what you want to do is, and this is, I think, among the hardest thing, is the people who are in the company who are running the day-to-day operations need to be focused on activities that are going to lead to the long-term growth of the company, period. Period. If they're doing activities that have no growth, why are they even doing the activities? And so the issue is you've got people just going and doing the daily functions without anybody looking back strategically, and that's where the board can come in. Board can come in as an outside perspective, and they can look and think about strategically, okay, what is this getting us to? What are we trying to do? Does it even make sense? You know, we had a client of ours that had four divisions, and one of the divisions was just bleeding money. I mean, losing $17 million a year, actually, for this one division. But the other three were very profitable, and the company had no debt, family-owned business based in the Midwest. So you would say, okay, logically, the first thing to do is just close down this division. You can be making a lot more money, obviously. But they had emotional involvement. It was how the business originally started, the grandfather had started the business, now they had, they're in their fourth generation. So it was an emotional connection. So you, there are some decisions that aren't necessarily rational decisions, but they're emotional decisions. You know, we convinced them actually to consider other options, which one of the other options was actually selling it off and having somebody else come in to acquire it. So therefore, they would no longer be involved in the division. And but the biggest concern in the room with the CEO was he didn't want to go down to the Rotary Club and tell the people he laid off all these people. Like, that was his biggest concern. And therefore, him losing this money every year, well, we still make money at the end. And they were. They made a lot of money, very, very profitable. You know, they had their own corporate jet, great lifestyle, you know, flew to New York to get their suits done. I mean, so it wasn't an issue in terms of were they making money or not. It was, but it was an emotional issue. So sometimes there are issues that just are not rational. But I believe part of the board responsibility is really to push the boundaries. Push the boundaries, but not in any offensive way. You know, to really ask the questions. I also think that if you say, like, what are missing pieces that happen with growth and strategy is, who's our customer, right? So if you look at whether it's a client or it's a consumer, and are they actually using third parties to go out and survey them? So you sit on these boards, you go through these boards, and you start, and they, what you hear is you talk, the CEO or CFO is talking about their customer, but you actually have no information that's really valid information on the customer or on the client. So it's great for the CEO to be saying, well, this is our brand and this is what it represents in the marketplace, but go out, do these surveys, not you, have an outside firm go and actually survey your own customers and clients and let them talk about your company. What does it mean to them? You know, who do they consider, you know, find out that information. That's valuable information. That should be presented to the board. But what happens is a lot of them don't do it. Just like I am not a huge fan of board reports. You know, have a two-hour board meeting focused on board reports does not make sense. It's actually a total waste of time for most of the people in the room. Send the reports in advance so people can review them and ask questions, highlight the key things, and then get to the strategic issues, including the growth issues. So. Yeah.
My experience has been on a number of board boards that as a member of management, while I don't sit in on all of the board sessions, I sat in on a number of them. Mm-hmm. And the best of my knowledge, I cannot remember a single time a board member addressed the CEO to even ask a simple question. When was the last time you visited our major customer? It's not to your point, it's not being confrontational, it's not being, but I found that many board members, it gets very collegial, it gets very polite, and they don't want to offend, they don't want to embarrass, but they don't ask the questions that you read at the beginning of the session about the key questions they should be asking the CEO about strategy and growth.
And yet the best CEOs are out there. They're out there. You look at Costco, it's a perfect example. Costco became number one, number two, and number three warehouse. And if you look at it logically, when they start off and then when they did the acquisition on the West Coast, you would say, how are they possibly going to compete against Sam's with Walmart? I mean, come on, you got Walmart backing Sam's, and they literally dominated the category and very smart. But if you look at the CEO, Jim Senegal, who ran it and built it, he was out there in stores all the time. You could run into him in stores. He lived in the stores. He would ask people questions. He would look at the packaging. He would look at the positioning of the product. He would look at the end caps. He would see what's selling. He wanted to understand what was driving the business and driving the category. And I mean, really a smart, in retail, which isn't the easiest anyways, really a very, very smart approach. You take a look at it today, it's the same formula he came up with. 80% of the items are the same items. They change the brands. 20% of impulse items, you surround the store with the impulses when they come in, and you always change those up to make it a fresh, different experience. And then they only mark up things 12 to 18% religiously. So no matter, so their whole goal as buyers is very clear. You want to buy it for the absolute lowest price you can. So then the question, where's the profit? Where's the profit made? One place. Anyone know? Correct, the cards. So the membership fees. So the cards, the 2 or 3 cents that it costs them to make the card, 2.5 cents, 3 cents, that make the card, that they charge $55 to $110 for it, is where the money's made. And why do you become member? To get that whole experience and be able to buy your things at the right price. So when they can go and drive, so for instance, we have a client in the toy business, so it's at the toy show in New York. So I talked to the Costco buyer, and I don't know if anybody's been in there recently, but you see those bears, and they have these huge bears. And these huge bears will retail $99. And he was at the toy show negotiating this deal. I mean, he was going to go and purchase, I mean, it was a huge quantity of these bears. But they're the huge bears, $99 retail. They're selling them today for $39.99. I mean, so that's unbelievable pricing for that bear. I mean, you can't compare that anywhere else. What it is, it's marked up 12%. But they originally were selling that in the marketplace. They were getting $48 was the selling price to the retailer who was putting it out at, you know, Keystone Double Plus, $99. And they went in and said, we'll buy this huge quantity. You got to give us your best price. And they went back and back driving it down. So they really drove it down. Yes, Helen?
I'd like to go back to that point about customers. Because I think that's a good point. You know, a lot of times, and spend a lot of time with the CEO about how to make things
right.
But one of the things that at least my board has done is several times a year we actually do our board meetings at a customer site. Now a lot of these are tech companies, these are large customers, for example, Ransom Board and Power Company. We would go, they would sell back to the house, as an example. And so we would go do a board session, and the customer would come in and talk about the things that worked for the product and didn't work for the product, what they wanted to do. And so, I mean, I wish it was a time, but certainly was, and every board meeting was spent a fair amount of time talking about customer strategy and how they were part of the interworking of the board governance. And most of our boards have done that, more or less, sometimes it depends on what else. But, you know, to your point, Larry, I mean, best CEOs, you know, I mean, they know what they're doing, and they spend time with them.
Did you find when you went to these board meetings, I've been to board meetings, they do off-site different locations, do you actually get a tour of the place? Because that's another thing. Sometimes doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you have the meeting there, and then you don't get the whole tour.
And they do this in small groups. And so you're all group different people asking questions. That's
great.
And so, and then the independent directors will sit down after them and talk about what they heard and what the questions we ask.
Our company takes it a step further. So we run a client advisory board 3 or 4 times a year with 15 or 20 of our clients. We have 3 inside board members and 3 external board members, and one of the external board members attends at least 1 meeting annually. And we run it in more of a roundtable session. We pose questions. It's not a selling zone because nobody will come to those. And then you're getting multiple people. Because the multiple people takes it to the next step in terms of, are you hearing something consistently in terms of what the issue is, what needs you're solving, how you're different and better, and you're hearing it from multiple folks. So that's a question for the CEO or for the company is, if you're not running a client advisory board or a customer advisory board, why aren't you? You should, so that you can get in one shot a lot of good information.
Yeah. All right, so can I question that?
Sure.
I'm not sure. I love your idea. It's fabulous and it's something that you can do with it. But I don't think it's supposed to take one shot. To me, this is a continual, you know, the customer is with you forever, and by more and more. So it's a continual evolution of how you keep doing that and how you keep getting to the end of the information.
My thought about the one shot is that you can hear from multiple customers. same venue, as opposed to, okay, if you were at Bank of America this year, and then next year you're at, you know, General Motors or pick somebody. You're getting one data point in terms of what were they doing with the particular product. Well, that's nice, but can I extrapolate that to tens, hundreds, thousands? And in our case, we don't have that many customers. We have about 300 as an organization, and they're pretty representative. Plus, my job is to go out and meet a lot of them as well, so it's supplemented. But that's a good way for the board participants to meet with folks and to ask them privately what's going on, how are we doing, what could we be doing better, what are the gaps, what are the problems, what are the blind spots that we have, and as an independent board member, it's a very advantageous position.
Do you find the CEOs are doing it twice the cost of the world, small, medium, or large, and really that size? That mindset, if you will, are they more analytically focused? Versus the CEOs that are not, and maybe they're not even, the CEOs that are not, what's the difference in the mindset, the process, and the things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of Costco, Jim, I mean, he was very much hands-on, and by doing that and going to stores and working hard, he sent a message out just by doing that in and of itself. And he was very analytical. I mean, and I think the best CEOs out there are, they're very much tied to the analytics, very much tied to the metrics. They know and understand what they need to be watching. So, I mean, we're big fans of having, like, an executive scorecard. You know, one page that shows you basically the map of the business of where it stands. It can be basic cash APAR. It can have the factories, if they're doing importing, what's being brought in, what's export, you know, what the key metrics that are important for that business, and then also doing how do you compare to the rest of the industry. Because that's all, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, relative growth is important. To say that our company is going to grow, we have a plan to grow 20% this year, great. What's the industry growing, 10% or 50, right? If it's growing 10%, you know, that's very good. If it's growing 50%, you're not doing that good. So that's also in terms of looking at it.
If that's kind of, in your experience, proving success, because they're doing these steps, why have the other ones taken these steps?
People tend to focus on what they're good at. That's where they spend their time. What you find with most CEOs, oh, I came out of sales, really? Oh, right, and you find out they're spending 60% of their time still in sales. Oh, I came out of marketing, oh, really? I never guessed that by spending a day with you. That's what they tend to, that's the human tendency.
Engineering or finance.
Yeah, engineering, finance, I mean, all the things, the tech companies that are just horrible when it comes to marketing their product in general, but, right, it's what they come out of, is what they're comfortable with, and that's where they spend their time. And that's problematic because they're not seeing the holes and gaps and they're not seeing the holistic picture of the company. They're not often using the metrics they need. And they don't even understand what the key metrics are. That's the other thing. You know, how do you compare to your competitors in this? You get like blank stares or you get answers that don't make sense. But these are the same CEOs, by the way, when you ask them about, are you doing quarterly reviews with your top 10 customers? Absolutely, great. So 10 customers, quarterly reviews, great, 40. How many did you attend? You ask the CEO. Listen to the action versus work. Most of them, give us a number. I don't know, 32, 33, great. We get into the company, we look, we find out they did 18 last year, not 40. And of the 18, 12 were done at the shows that they hold. So only 6 were done off-site. And by the way, of those 18, how many focused on the future and future growth? 0. What they did is just reported the numbers they did. That's not a quarterly review. That's the same with the CEO who sits down with the CFO once a month and gets the financials. Okay, what do you do with the financials? Are you managing the financials? Are you talking about trends in the industry? No, I just, you know, I look at it, I take it, I just file it away. Okay, well, that's not any action steps on it. We should be talking about the trends and what's going on in the industry. The other thing we see sometimes is CEOs are very reluctant at sharing some information that the management team needs to have. And if they don't, if the management team that's supposed to be empowered doesn't have the key information, doesn't understand what the focus is, doesn't understand what the priorities are, and they don't understand how they're supposed to grow, how is it possibly going to happen because it's in the CEO's office with the door closed? It doesn't make sense.
Sam Walton had that same model. He was always out in the stores. There's an internal communications aspect of this as well. I like to walk around any organization and ask people, when's the last time you saw the CEO? When is the last time you saw your senior VP? And you'd be surprised. Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Bill Marriott is a great example, because one of the reasons I love Marriott properties, everybody that works at Marriott for any length of time not only has met Bill, they have a picture of themselves with Bill, and they feel like part of the family.
That's great. No, and I agree with you, both Bill Marriott and Sam Walton are great examples. I have, back in my Procter & Gamble days, I was responsible for coordinating the visit. Sam Walton was coming to P&G headquarters in Cincinnati. And all of a sudden, and it was the morning, 11 a.m. meeting with the CEO and chairman of the board to talk about Walmart and what Procter & Gamble at the time was looking at having a whole Walmart team, which they have now today down there, based in Benton. And so it's supposed to be 11 a.m. My phone rings at 10 a.m. And who is it but Sam? So he said, I'm pulling up to your headquarters. Can you come downstairs? And I'm like, well, the meeting isn't until 11. No, you just come downstairs. So I ran downstairs, and he pulled up in this $30 rental car, by the way. He wouldn't let us pick him up at the airport, of course. And he pulled up to the headquarters, and he said, what time do I have to be back in? I said, well, it's 11 a.m. He said, no problem, I got an hour. I can go hit a couple stores, and he took off. So talk about someone dedicated and devoted, and talk about someone who knew and understood the business. I mean, and in the stores, he was magnetic. I mean, he was like a cheerleader to those people. So that's a whole different thing. But talk about someone who knew and understood the business and the processes.
But the larger the company, the more challenging it is.
Right.
But how often have people seen their leader?
Right.
I mean, how recently?
I think that is key.
Have they seen their leader? It's a good question.
Yep. There's someone.
I just think it's a very, very interesting discussion. What it seems to me is that in all kinds of leadership, what you were saying is in lean management principles,
right.
Is go and see what's happening. Regardless of the package you receive. So it's extremely important that the leaders are connected to the business that they have to do. The thing is, I think that if there is a will, then they do have the information about their customers. They can see that from their receivable. If it is basically that the receivable is telling you what your customers really think about your product or service. If you look at your payables and your procurement, you will see what your suppliers are thinking about. You will be able to evaluate your goods very, very accurately just through looking at that. But if there is no will, then none of that matters. So I think boards as independent, the independent director should be assessing if there is a will and help if there is a will. If there isn't a will, then the CEO.
We're going to stop in about five minutes, but we'll continue the conversation, just give people an opportunity to leave if they need to leave.
I'm thinking about this from your point of view as an outside consultant, or let's say my point of view as a board member, let's say on a family board, there's a company going on for a long time. And so let's say the CEO said, yes, we want to grow, but saying it and doing it are two different
right.
things. And I'm kind of wondering how you determine if there really is a desire to grow, meaning are you willing to take on risk? Are you willing to take on the cultural change within the organization that would be required to do that? And again, I'm thinking of this in the constructive engagement way that you were talking about. What do you see as that process that you're going in, or somebody tomorrow on the board in the position of, well, we want your company to grow, we want to position it for sale eventually, come in and say, okay, well, is this actually going to happen as opposed to the lip service?
Right. So actions versus words. It's sort of like when companies go for sale and they have a laundry list of initiatives. And having been on the other side and engaged in literally hundreds of acquisitions, none of those lists are believable. They have zero credibility. You can't tell me you've been running a company for 28 years, and by the way, you should buy my company and pay up for it, because if you did this, 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 the company would be even more valuable. Well, why haven't you done any of these things, right? You've been running this company for 28 years. So another thing we very much encourage our clients is, if you've identified these initiatives, do them. Do them today. Do them a couple years in advance. Do them 5 years in advance. Do them 10 years in advance. Whatever you want to do, but do them. It is much more credible to say, we've done this initiative. We did $3.5 million in last year, and this year we project we're going to do $5 million. Then coming out and saying, I'm going to do $5 million next year. Really? And how much? What'd you do last year? None. But you know, if you come in and acquire this, you can do this. So that's unbelievable. So I think that most entrepreneurs spend their time running their business, but not growing their business. And they don't realize how important the long term is until all of a sudden it hits them, and they're like, oh, you know, now I got to do something, sort of thing, unless they're required to. So they should be spending a minimum of a quarter, even up to half of their business, really focusing on the things that really matter, the hiring and training of people, you know, going into expanding into new markets, developing new products, doing all the things that are really around the growth of the business. But where they end up spending the time is on running the business, on doing the fire drills, on the division that's losing money. Oh, that's where I spend my time. Okay, well, allocate your time. Tell us how much of your time you're actually spending, or look at how much of your time you're spending in this division that's losing money. Should you even be in that business, number one? That's the first question. That's two. If you are going to be in it, you got to figure out a way to make it profitable. But don't spend all your time on this as opposed to your other three divisions are making money. And by the way, if you spent your time on these other three, they could be doing double or triple the sales. Where are you devoting your own time? I think there's a myth out there that these companies don't need a strategic growth plan. And it can't be something in their head. That you need it to guide the actions of the company. You need to have the process in place. You need to look at how you continually improve the process. If there's nothing down on paper, no one else knows what it is. It's all in the CEO's head. So we very much encourage putting it down paper. And yes, it requires more time up front, but we believe it actually saves a lot of time in the future by doing this. So
let me stop at this point because it's 6 o'clock. If anybody wants to leave, feel free to leave. If anybody wants to stay, feel free to stay. Darren.
Mm-hmm. I must preface my comments by saying I'm not a board member, but I've been an advisor and a keen observer of numerous boards for whom I've been employed. One of the common threads in successful or unsuccessful CEO and board seems to be the ability of the CEO to get outside his own comfort zone. If he's a salesman, right. Fine, but if he may be a division general manager, but now he's going to be CEO of a $1 billion, say, food company, how do you get him outside the comfort zone of only talking sales? And I guess my question is, how successful
you give them a few meetings with Larry.
Yeah, that's right. Not Larry. But,
how successful, how frequent is the transition of a CEO from his professional discipline to the role of CFO or CEO, where he has to be an expert at everything, not just everything he's done in his work?
Right. It all depends. It's very dependent on the person. But I think the best of them out there recognize what they're good at and what they're not good at. And they try to fill the slots with the weaknesses. Say, you know what, I'm not so good in these areas, but I'm going to hire the best people I can in these areas. The ones that don't are the ones that the whole company suffers as a whole, or they somehow feel threatened as the CEO by hiring these people. What if they're better than me? Great, have them better than you. That makes your job easier, not worse. So,
I'd like to comment on that. I had this fabulous interview with the CEO of a company everybody around this table would know. And he started the company, and he had friends and family, and then it went to became a venture capital-backed company, and then it became a public company, and he survived to the through that entire process. Now it's a public company, it's a global company. And I said, what's your secret? Because most CEOs don't survive that process. He says, one is, I can't expect the board to force me to change. Their responsibility is to hire and fire the CEO. So if anybody's going to change, it's got to be me. Two is, I can't make the change when I'm weak. Because when I'm weak, there's nothing that I can do that will satisfy the board. So if I'm going to change, I have to change when I'm strong and when the results are strong. Third is, he says, I have to be close to my strength and have to be closer to my weaknesses. This is exactly what Larry was saying. He says, I've got to be more sensitive about my weaknesses than my strengths. And as the company grows, I've got to hire the people who are strong in the areas that I'm weak. And I've got to do it when the company's doing well. Because if I do it when the company's not doing well, I can't hire the right people, and the board's not going to trust me. So he sort of explained kind of a methodology that I thought, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I just want to add to what Larry said. But there's also a role, because I do sit in on many board meetings and I get to see interaction. And part of my role doesn't turn on and off with the outside of management, the inside of the board of directors. If I'm observing whether it's a CEO who's getting some signals from board members to pull them aside after and say, hey, let me just share with you kind of what I observe. And that's one piece of the conversation, but this is the piece that takes a lot of manager courage and comfort level and knowledge of the board. I pulled board members aside and said, I observed that you were kind of probing in this direction. This is a newly minted CEO. You've walked in those moccasins before. You've had that experience. Like, schedule a lunch, schedule a dinner, put your arm around and walk him down to the end of the pier and have the adult conversation about what you wanted to say to him but couldn't say in the room. Now, I have experiences where it worked very well and there was a positive response, and I've had experiences where it didn't work so well, where the CEO wasn't really open to. And again, to the point where earlier, it was outside of his comfort zone.
I just very quickly, Ed, there's a great article in Chief Executive Magazine this month about CEOs getting that kind of input, how you get it, and how you send signals that you don't want it. It's a great article.
In contrast, in your experience, how many CEOs are actually, you know, during the course of their career, have actually managed it to the point where they have, you know, moved sideways at any point in time? So they haven't come up with one functional area. They've purposely gone to two or three different, you know, gaining functional skills in at least three different areas in order to, you know, counteract what you just described, which is like, you know, they're stuck in a pitching mode and they eventually get the top score.
Larger companies that happens with, smaller middle market companies, that normally does not happen. You know, sometimes they'll come from a large company and then go in and start their own company. But they again tend to focus or been good at one particular area. But that rarely happens. I mean, large companies try to, oh, we'll put them on special assignment. They can work in all these different areas. They can work in internet. They try to expose them. But that doesn't happen much.
Anybody else? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, there will be a copy of this MP3. We will be sending it out to you within a few weeks. We hope you can join us next month for a seat at the table. You'll be getting a notice about that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And feel free to continue to stay and schmooze.
Schmooze.